How Life Does Intrude. Episode 18, this one has been intruded upon so much. Going to drag it, kicking and screaming, though, into existence. It's going to take place. It's going to be uploaded. Obviously, since you're listening to it, I was successful. Welcome. Or welcome back to International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. I'm Adam Five. Thank you very much for listening. Episode 18 is going to deal with communication, or rather, miscommunication, or rather, misinterpretation, or maybe all those things. I always seem to feel the need to apply many different terms to the same thing, no matter what I'm talking about. I don't know why I do that. I can't seem to go from one sentence, from the beginning of a sentence to the end of a sentence without applying similes to everything. But anyway, hi. Thank you again. Here at the top of the show, as always, will be the time for acknowledgments, shout-outs, thank yous, hellos, welcomes, etc., because that's what I do at the beginning of the show. And first and foremost, this is a long overdue thank you to Mr. Sam Chupp of the Bears Grove podcast for his recommendation of International Detective Dragons from Outer Space in his show number 20. You may recall at the top of episode 17, in the letter that I read from Derek from Texas, who was writing actually about the granite time capsule from episode 12, but at the very top of the letter, he made a reference to IDDFOS being compared to a bran muffin. And I didn't get it at the time because I hadn't listened to any of the Bears Grove podcasts. I hadn't heard that one. And so, of course, I went immediately to go check it out. Actually, the first thing I did was to locate and download the promo for the Bears Grove podcast and go ahead and put that in episode 17, and then went and checked it out. So I heard that episode. I heard the episodes available, actually all of them, and I recommend, of course, going and checking out the Bears Grove podcast. Thank you again, Mr. Chupp, for recommending IDDFOS. Next, a welcome and a thank you to Derek from Texas for joining the IDDFOS Frapper Map. Also a big welcome and a thank you to Jim from Youngstown, Ohio, who is also on the Frapper Map. Also a welcome and a thank you to Sarah from Does My Geek Look Big in This, who also joined the Frapper Map. Our membership now is up to 8. There are now 8 superior and elite beings who have something that you may not, and that is a pin on the International Detective of Dragons from Outer Space Frapper Map. Go ahead and join it. It's a very simple thing to do. If you go to www.anim5.com, click on the little yellow dummy in your right-hand side lower corner. That'll take you to the IDDFOS webpage. Scroll down towards the bottom, look to your right, you'll see a little doggy's head. That is one of my 2 dogs. Just above the doggy is a map, little square rectangular thing. Click that, that'll take you to Frapper, that'll take you to the IDDFOS map. Go ahead and put your pin on it. That way I'll have an idea where you are. And it struck me as I looked at the map and saw the 8 members there, seeing Sarah's pin over in England and seeing the Norwegian Vikings pin, it struck me that that truly makes us the International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. And that's really kind of special. It strikes home the message that podcasts reach around the world. And for a second there, it made me tongue-tied as I actually realized what I was saying and what it meant. So I better move on quickly. Speaking of Sarah from Does My Geek Look Big in This, Sarah and Nev have sent bumpers. And you'll be hearing the little audio bumpers of the type that indicate you are listening to. You've heard them on other shows from other people. And it was really super to get hold of those. And you'll be hearing those in rotation. They sent 3 different bumpers on this show and shows to follow. And a big thank you to both of them for that. a little announcement that's going to be old news by the time you hear this. If you listen to gamer podcasts at all, you'll already know this, so it's going to be old news to you, but I have to say, welcome back. The Mad Three of Gamer the Podcasting have returned. If you haven't checked it out, go ahead and use whatever it is you use to get hold of podcasts and download their episode 21, the first show of their second season. Lots of fun. They start out talking about... Actually, I don't remember what they start out talking about. I do. What I remember is the Vacuform segment under the special effects. So lots of fun to listen to, and very glad that they have returned. Welcome back, Caroline, Jeff, and Sasha. I wanted to... Oh, and here, before I throw in two little supplements, a new listener email, a listener that I haven't heard from before, and I'm going to read that email right now. The name is George, and the subject line is Your Show Number 17. Just wanted to send you a note to let you know that I rated your show at replayvideo.com. Well done. I've got two podcasts, Eclectic Mix and 1 Minute How To. If you get a chance, then I invite you to check them out. And if you enjoy them, then feel free to offer a quick review at replayvideo.com. I checked out both of those, actually. Eclectic Mix, I invite you to, of course, I'll put the links to both those podcasts in the notes. I'd invite you to take a look at them. Eclectic Mix is up to show number 50 by now, and it looks like there's plenty of artists being featured. Check out their mission statement. If you do nothing else, read the mission statement. It just can't be argued with. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do, essentially offering a broadening of the mind as far as music is concerned. The 1 Minute How To is also extremely interesting. I checked out one of them. There's a very wide range of 1 Minute How To episodes where someone tells how to do something in a minute. I went, of course, straight to the how to do a stage combat move one. That's not real surprising for me. But I'll put links to both those shows in the schnotes. And that was not the letter. That was not the end of the letter. I'll continue now. Sorry. As far as a time capsule is concerned, I wouldn't bother. The vast majority of time capsules are lost forever, basically because people forget about them. I did create somewhat of a time capsule when I was about 10 years old. Jeff B. and I put some change in a bottle and buried it, with the idea that someday we would dig it up. Although I remember the general location, since it is on someone else's property today, I'll never know whether or not it's there. Of course, that was about 45 years ago, and there's nothing to tell me that the next day Jeff didn't dig it up himself and spend the money. You can
never trust even your best friend. It's like Shades of Treasure of Sierra Madre. You got to keep an eye on everybody.
Sorry. Anyway, back to the letter. If someone is looking for a nonviolent interactive game, although it might be a little bit of a stretch, I could recommend trying out Second Life. It's not a game per se, but is fun and interesting. I do know people who have gotten very much into it and spend what I consider to be way too much time there, but that's their choice. Anyway, keep going with your show. I found it interesting and enlightening. Cheers, George.
Thank you very, very much, George. What George didn't mention actually in his letter... Oh, and by the way, it looks like there's a second endorsement for trying out Second Life as an online interactive live multiplayer experience that is nonviolent. So I'm actually starting to thinking of getting in there myself and checking it out. It's just that time is a commodity I don't have a lot of lately, and I have the feeling that I would get so thoroughly into it that quite a bit would suffer as a result of it, so I'm kind of holding off. The curiosity probably, though, is going to get to me, and I'll probably be able to give you a first-hand account of what it's like in there. Judging by what I heard on the Bears Grove podcast, although it is not a podcast about Second Life, to the best of my knowledge, I only heard the three available episodes through the feed, Mr. Chuck may have something to say about what it's like in there, because it sounded to me like he's got some experience from being in there. And if any of you out there have some experience with Second Life, send a short review. Say you like it, say you don't like it, what it's like, how it's different from World of Warcraft. I'll read it right here on the show. Or send an audio. Anyway, George, that letter that I just read, who's got the two podcast. What he didn't mention is that Eclectic Mix came out number 6 in the top 10 Podcast Pickle Wars final winners. So congratulations there to George of Eclectic Mix and the 1 Minute How To. Now, I wanted to offer two quick things that relate to the past two podcasts. The past two were episodes 16 and 17, which were the two-parter dealing with massive multiplayer online role-playing games. Just to put a capper on that for now before we get into the next subject, or today's subject. And here's the first of those two things. I got the impression, just listening to especially episode 17, that I was giving a picture of the type of person that plays MMOs. I was portraying online role players, or rather online multiplayers, as being socially dysfunctional loners that essentially coming across as if people who play these games, that there's something wrong with them. And I certainly don't want to give that impression, because it's not true. And I think what really steered it in that direction, what kind of made that happen, was dealing with the question itself, can MMO RPGs ruin lives? And of course, in order to answer the question, we'd have to focus on, which I did, lives that would most likely be ruined by anything, not necessarily an MMO. And in a way to kind of counterbalance that, I'd like to briefly touch on this topic that came to my attention actually through, I think it was either Extra Life Radio or The Instance. And this is an article, or rather a post, that was found on the World of Warcraft threads. A gentleman that was playing the game, that was playing World of Warcraft, shortly before Christmas of 2005, was diagnosed with Burkitt's lymphoma, a very malignant form of cancer, and had to undergo a rigorous treatment of chemotherapy, essentially 9 months of chemotherapy within 3 months. And of course, it was a procedure that could very likely at any time have killed him. It weakened him severely. Needless to say, he was unable to work. When he was diagnosed, he was undergoing the treatment, while he could still play, he was playing World of Warcraft and belonged to a guild. In most of these MMOs, if you're not familiar with them at all and have never played them, you can form little groups or clubs within them. I don't know what they're called in other MMOs, but in World of Warcraft, they're called guilds. And essentially, you band together with people that you either enjoy playing with or just want to be a part of a big, massive, many-player club or group that works together to bring down big monsters. The guild was aware of his situation, and the members of the guild formed a PayPal donation setup and situation. And, of course, individual members of the guild donated to this guy and his family because they were going to lose everything. They were going to have their electricity shut off. I'm going to post a link directly to the thread. I urge you to read it. It essentially shows you that the type of people that play this game are just normal, everyday, average people that enjoy playing an online role-playing game. They're not the dire, dysfunctional, psychologically questionable stereotype that I put forth in episode 17 while answering that question. But this was a good thing to read, because these people raised money and kept this guy and his family afloat, even though he had made appeals to local charities, the state government, the federal government. I mean, you have to read it to appreciate it. It's too long for me to read right now, but please find it in the show notes, check it out. It's just a very positive thing. The other item is game creation software. Now, I've had a link to this. I've had this on my favorites for about 5 years now. Occasionally, I lose it, and I go looking for it again. The link, the site actually, and I'll put this in the show notes also, is www.3dgamestudio.com. And what it is a game creation kit wherein you can create your own 3D world for a character to run around in, just like in most of the MMOs. I don't know whether it supports online
multiplayer in its end product, but what you can do with it is create your own world, your own terrain, your own object. If you create terrain using Terragen, you can import that. As far as 3D model formats, it looks like it supports quite a few, but I keep going back to this place, and again, just like with Second Life, there's actually two things that stop me. One, I know if I got into it, I would be so completely submerged that I wouldn't even have time to quit my job. I'd just get fired for not showing up. I get completely submerged in creating a new universe and having fun with this game, with this 3D game creation software. The other thing is its price range. It goes from $50 to $900. And I think there's like a $90 version, there's a $200 version, all with different capabilities, depending on just how far you want to go and what you want to do with it. But I'm thinking to myself, if anybody out there is interested in creating an entire universe to explore, whether it has monsters in it to fight or not, or whether you just want to create that incredible world where you walk around and talk to NPCs and discover things and travel across mountains and rivers and find villages and find ancient ruins and go into submerged caves, that kind of thing. Essentially, that's what you can do with this thing. It's got something like 800,000 users worldwide. It's gotten very big over the past 5 years. I have not actually gotten it and used it, so I can't tell you, hey, this is great, go get it. But I can't tell you anything about it except that it exists. So anybody out there that's interested, even in creating an audio 3D realm, like I mentioned in the last episode for PC gaming for the blind, it's got support for stereo sound positioning. So you might want to check that out, if anything, just to see what's available. Again, it's not for everybody. I think there's a certain degree of skill that you have to bring to it, but it just looks like one of those winners to me that I'm eventually going to get one day, or I'm going to kick myself for never having gotten it. What does that bring me to? That brings me to, I think, maybe the first break. And when I come back, as I mentioned in the last episode, I wanted to give further treatment to the letter from Derek or Agent Desilu regarding that granite time capsule. I'm not going to reread the entire letter, but some portions of it to get us into today's topic. And while I said today's topic is miscommunication and misinterpretation, that is not to say that Derek in any way miscommunicated anything. It's just that what he wrote put me in mind of the possibilities of miscommunication, and that specifically having to do with leaving something behind for aliens to find, or rather sending something way out into space. So when I come back, that'll be the next thing to hit. So here's a short break, and back in a bit.
Hello, I'm Nev.
And I'm Sarah.
From Does My Geek Look Big In This.
And you're listening to International Detective Dragons from Outer Space.
The best detective dragons in the universe.
Okay then, to get into it, let me just go right to the paragraphs that I wanted to repeat from Derek's letter. In the compartments, I would probably include the works of Shakespeare, as well as the works of whatever the major playwrights are for other civilizations. Probably the Ramayana, the Tao Te Ching, the Prince, the biographies of major military leaders from around the globe, possibly even the biographies of several peacemakers like Churchill, Mandela, Mao Zedong, George Washington, more bios on major scientists, all of these on some compressed format storage device, be it microfilms or fiche or in the computer-type devices. Further down in the letter, if one of the compartments alone was a hard drive, you could easily put several terabytes or more in the capsule, which frees up so much space for anything you'd like. I suppose the reflective surface would be useful, and on it I'd inscribe a Rosetta Stone of language, very small, very complete. Now, these three elements of the letter catch my attention because they deserve further response than just thank you for the letter. I'm right alongside Derek's intentions to include all the different
literary works that he mentions, and he mentions a lot more than just what I read. You can hear the whole letter at the top of episode 17. But I'm right alongside him as far as preserving those things, because I chose works of literature myself to include in the granite monolith. But I believe that the reason I chose them isn't so much that I expected them to actually be read and understood, but as a kind of a personal gratification that somewhere out in the universe, these literary works would continue to exist beyond the earth and the sun. It was kind of an ultimate anti-book-burning statement on my part, a totally personal thing wherein it would make me feel good to know that they still existed out there somewhere. I think when I was thinking up the exercise, and obviously it's a completely hypothetical and fantastic premise to begin with, just the fact that a 10 by 10 by 2 foot thick granite slab would be lifted off the earth for any amount of money and then sent out of the solar system, it's fun to think about and very interesting, but certainly would never be done. However, what would you put in it if it were? And while I was thinking up the premise, I didn't actually ever believe that no matter who found it, 1,000 years from now, 200,000 years from now, or 2 million years from now, out there in the depths, I never actually believed that they'd really understand human print. I think Derek in the letter is adding the parameter to the exercise that we should assume not only that it will be found, but that the intelligence that finds it would be able to interpret all that they find on this granite slab into the nearest approximation of their own language. And that would certainly be a fascinating thing. It'd be wonderful if they actually understood it, but I just don't see it happening. I don't see how it possibly could happen. The second element to talk about here is that Rosetta Stone, a very, very complete... What did he say here? I suppose the reflective surface would be useful, and on it I'd inscribe a Rosetta Stone of language, very small, very complete. That might actually be useful for us if we found it, that is, human beings, if we actually managed to find it however many years from now, assuming that we knew, that we had some knowledge of at least one of the languages. In other words, if you were to put the same... I'm assuming people know what the Rosetta Stone is. In other words, if we were to put a, as Derek says, if we were to put a paragraph or two on there in English, and then that exact same paragraph translated into every other major language on Earth, that would allow for an interpretation of the rest of whatever works are included. And that's the key point here is, unless you have a knowledge of at least one of those languages, unless you know what at least one of those languages means, then it doesn't act as the kind of key it's supposed to. It doesn't act as the same kind of key that the actual Rosetta Stone acted as for scholars of ancient languages when it was discovered. But if we ourselves actually were to find it, and we knew of some ancient language, if however many years from now English turned out to be the Latin of today, although I doubt it, I don't know, then it could be used to interpret any of the other foreign language works that were included in the granite slab. And finally, the other element of his letter that adds yet another caveat or another dimension to the exercise, another assumption on the part of the alien intelligence that finds the thing, is the hard drive device, the terabytes of information that can be fit on a hard drive that takes up one of the complete compartments. And that is the assumption that they would be able to actually retrieve information from a digital storage medium of that type. And that's a perfectly fine parameter to add. I mean, if we're going to engage in fantasy on this level, we might as well go all the way and assume that they could. My problem with it is it falls apart as soon as I start thinking about it realistically, even for a second. Because currently the only method of information storage that we have that has not become obsolete over time is the printed word. The most efficient method of storing a large amount of information that we've had over time that has not become obsolete is the book. I mean, if you think about it, you could get a hold of some Edison wax cylinders of some of the stuff that I played in previous podcasts as end show music, some of the really old stuff from around the turn from the 1800s to the 1900s and a little bit later. You can get a hold of some of those wax cylinders today, and maybe even some of those vinyl cylinders. But go ahead and try and find something to play them on. I mean, they're rare enough by themselves. You can't exactly just go and get the device that they made to play them on. You'd have to build it yourself or pay an exorbitant amount of money. I've got a Sierra game downstairs in my basement called Trial by Fire, which I enjoyed quite a bit when I played it. But if I wanted to play it right now, I couldn't. It's just incompatible. Now, and we're talking about human technology here on the same planet, developed by one species, and a separation of only about 14 years. 14 years ago I got that game, and I can't play it now. I don't know how many more decades it's going to be, but you can certainly expect to no longer see turntables available for playing vinyl LPs. I mean, there's generations now that have grown up in houses that have never had a vinyl LP, that are buying music now, that have never known anything but a CD. So in terms of technology, first of all, they'd have to know precisely what it was. They'd also have to know what the key was for decoding the digital information. And the other thing about it that it reminded me a little bit of, Independence Day. If you haven't seen Independence Day yet, I can't help you, but I'm going to ruin it for you. Here's a spoiler alert. If you haven't seen Independence Day with Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum, and go ahead and run out and get it. It's a lot of fun. It's War of the Worlds, a different take on War of the Worlds. But I kind of laugh a little bit at myself towards the end of that film because I can buy so much in the movie. And I'm sure this has been discussed and joked about and talked about in many different podcasts that I haven't heard, and in many different articles that have talked about the movie, but I find it easy to accept alien invasion. I find it easy to accept a giant mothership distributing other giant ships over the cities of Earth, the alien technology being superior, us getting a hold of a UFO from 50 years ago and the thing activating when the main ships begin their invasion. I can even buy Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum going up and getting into the mothership using it. The part that I have a hard time with, and I laugh at myself because of this, because I'm buying so much else about this total fantasy, what I laugh about is that they're going to take down the mothership with a virus from a laptop using radio waves or Wi-Fi or however they make the connection. That's another thing, too. You can't get a PC and a Mac to talk to each other without special software, or unless it's over the internet. And they're going to take down the mothership, the mothership's computer with a virus, integrating it into a totally alien technology. That to me is the biggest, the wildest, and most far-fetched piece of fantasy in the whole picture. But sorry, that just reminded me of that. But let's take everything. Let's take everything that Derek wanted to put in this granite time capsule and accept it as fully interpreted by whatever intelligent spacefaring alien race comes across it. Let's make the assumption. We'll make the wild leap and assumption, just as I made the wild leap that the thing could ever be put together in the first place, which is the point of the exercise. Let's make the assumption that they can actually interpret Fire and Ice by Robert Frost, or Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night by Dylan Thomas, or The Raven by Poe, and that they could retrieve the information, the audio, the radio broadcast, the TV specials, all of these things. Would the written information give them an accurate picture of who we are, or would they be so completely alien to us that they would not have any kind of frame of reference that would allow any of it to make any kind of sense. And I think, as I'm saying this, I'm coming across as me playing devil's advocate to my own exercise. Because the problem of interpreting the printed word or works of language, linguistic interpretation specifically, that I would anticipate alien races having when trying to come up with some sane and consistent picture of who the human race was, the problems began entering my line of thought when I think about the kind of foul-ups and miscommunications that have happened just here on Earth among ourselves, from one culture to the next and from one language to the next. And as I read down the list of what Derek selected to include as works of literature, and I recalled all those works of literature that I selected myself to have included in the monolith, a story kept entering my mind that I heard from a friend of mine years and years ago, and it had to do with international interpretation. I think it began with a discussion about accurate interpretation of the final selected books of the Bible from the ancient languages, where those books were derived from before they were written, what stories, and just how close the modern English interpretation of what is supposed to be the holy work that defines Western Christianity, just how close that is to the original meaning. And she brought up the point that when the film came out, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, when that film came out, they wanted to distribute it. They were distributing it overseas, and they had to retitle it, translating it to the local language. And I think it was Korea. I'm not sure, but I think it was South Korea. Could have been Japan. I'm having a hard time remembering now. But at any rate, the concept of the endearment, honey, as in you're honey, I'm home, that idea, that familiar, affectionate pet name for your wife or significant other, just did not exist in the language. Literally, they didn't have a local language equivalent of honey, I shrunk the kids. I don't even know if they had dear, I shrunk the kids. Nothing at least that would make it make sense as a title for a film to be distributed. And they ended up retitling it Micro Kids, our English equivalent of whatever it was they titled it in South Korea. And we're talking about just the title of a work not having a linguistic equivalent in as small a space as from one side of the earth to the other. And we're talking about sending these works, and well, I'm talking about sending works of literature out into the depths of space like 100 light years away. I don't even know that it would make it that far by the time the sun, whatever. I don't know how far and how fast granite has to travel in order to escape the end of the solar system, but not even going to get into that. And so it got me thinking about translations, communication, and communication that transcends language, because language apparently has a lot of pitfalls, aside from colloquialisms and regional phrases and terms that have a regional meaning that don't have any kind of meaning anywhere else on Earth. I remember reading, I don't know where, I don't know when, I don't know who wrote it, but one of the earliest, very earliest computer-powered text interpreters, was being tested among businessmen. I don't remember how many years ago, but several people were invited to input whatever sentence or phrase they wanted to get the Chinese equivalent. And one fellow typed in the phrase, out of sight, out of mind. And the interpretation into Chinese that came back, according to someone fluent in Chinese that was working on the project, what it said in Chinese was, invisible idiot. And as I remembered that, I thought, wow, wouldn't that be fun to try now? Because we have, actually, the online equivalent of that. We've got Babbel, the Babbelfish software. So I figured I'd give it a try. I took a very short paragraph, slightly stylized, and I put it into Babbel. I translated it from English to Spanish, then from Spanish to French, then from French to Dutch, and then from Dutch back to English. This is the original paragraph. Felix the Cat. The wonderful, wonderful cat. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks. Felix the Cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. You'll laugh so much, your sides will ache. Your heart will go pitter-pat, watching Felix the Wonderful Cat. Now that in itself, of course, is a lie. It almost sounds like a warning. Observation of this animated cat could cause possible side injury, and people using a pacemaker probably shouldn't watch it. I don't want my heart to go pitter-pat. And I'll tell you another thing. I don't remember quite how much I actually watched Felix the Cat when it was being repeated when I was a kid, but I never laughed, I think, out loud watching that cartoon. I never found anything so funny in that cartoon that I even laughed out loud, let alone laughed so much my sides ached. But we'll bypass that. We'll forget about that. I just wanted to use that as an example. Don't ask me why. I just did. So anyway, taking that, going into Babelfish, plugging it into Spanish, Spanish to French, French to Dutch, and Dutch back to English, I got Felix the Cat, the admirable, admirable cat, postulated that he obtains in an adaptation he reaches in its grant of turn. Felix the Cat, the admirable, admirable cat, you, Rhaera, as long as sides will be damage, it's heart palmadita, for the will love, it's those Felix, the admirable cat in the eye. Yes, that's what I got. Now, it went through a couple of iterations, I'll grant you, but that's from human being to human being, present day, using our current digital translation technology. I don't know what Rhaera means, R-E-I-R-A, with an accent on the A. I didn't actually have time to look up palmadita, P-A-L-M-A-D-I-T-A. If anybody finds out what those things means and feels like writing in, please do. But look what we got. Human to human. I wonder what aliens would think. Culturally, the differences can be amazing. The differences can be almost frightening. I can think of two examples. My wife was working in a situation where she came into contact with a lot of people from England who were over here for the World Cup, who were watching the World Cup, and the people from England were telling her that most of the United Kingdom people think that the people in the United States are these wacky, grossly overweight, gun-toting, violent, adulterous hillbillies, because most of what they see on television representing American culture, or at least what's pushed over there, most of what they see are things like the Ricky Lake show. What was the other example? The other example I can think of, and you might bear this in mind yourself, particularly when it gets to be round about Halloween, and you go into either one of those Halloween costume shops, or even today, go into a party store. Go into any party store and look in the costumes section or the gag gift section, and check out what's hanging on the shelves. Just take a good look at those gross rubber injection molded things being sold for $5, $6, or $7. Things like severed hands, artificial dog poo, little men that drop their trousers and fart, little plastic men that drop their trousers and fart when you squeeze a bulb. Try and imagine. I mean, there's all, just, you've seen it yourself. Picture it yourself. Try and imagine Chinese factory workers watching this stuff go by, what it is they think is on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. I've said it often enough, out loud, in the toy aisle, the Chinese must think we are freaking out of our minds. And they could be right. All right, time for another break, and I'll get back to it. Back in a bit. So there, where I left off, cultural differences, mainly in little manufactured, bizarre objects taken completely out of context as offering a clue to the culture that is willing to pay money for them. Well, there is a thought. Why not put fake vomit or rubber dog poo in the granite thing as well? I wonder what they'd make of that. Maybe that should have been one of the things in the last compartment that I put the toys in, or the Hulu, or the Slinky or whatever. But yeah, vast cultural differences as well. From one side of the ocean to the other, or from one side of the mountain to the other side of the mountain. When you look at how international the world is, well, when you look at how international the economic developed world is today, it becomes, for Americans anyway, it becomes difficult to conceive of the fact that countries as close together as Spain, France, and Germany could have developed such vastly different languages when you don't take into consideration the long history behind the formation of each country. But as a cultural concept, one of the things that I could be remembering incorrectly, because I'm drawing on brain cells that have endured too many heat waves. Oh, I'm not going to start talking about this heat wave. It's, as I record this, it's the 3rd of August, and I'm on the East Coast, the upper portion of the East Coast of the United States, and we're getting what California got last week or a week and a half ago. See what I mean about me starting at one end, starting at one end of a sentence, heading north, and by the time I reach the other end of the sentence, I'm in the Orion Nebula. I may be misremembering this, I may be wrong, but I think the American Indian, the Native American Indian, found it a completely bizarre and alien concept brought over by the white man that you could actually own land, that land ownership was possible. It seemed a completely strange thing to them. And it, you know what? It doesn't even have to be from one culture to another. It doesn't even have to be geographic distance. It can be time within the same language. A prime example of that would be that wherefore example I gave when I was giving my pet peeve over the Shakespeare line from Romeo and Juliet, "Wherefore art thou Romeo?" Just the passage of time has allowed that to be misinterpreted. Whereas originally she was saying, "Why are you named Romeo?" it has turned into, "Where are you, Romeo?" Simply because 400 years went by. I mean, the language, granted, is difficult to understand from the vantage point of the year 2006, but it doesn't have to be geographic distance. Cultural acceptance of things. And some of the classic works that we would include in a time capsule, from the Iliad to Catch 22, sending things like that out into space, how could they get an accurate picture when we don't culturally believe the same things that we held as fact and took for granted only 100 to 150 years ago? It used to be a cultural attitude, and some people may argue that the attitude still exists. I think to a certain extent it does. It certainly did all the way up until the 50s, that somehow the major developed countries were culturally superior to everyone else on Earth simply because they could do things by pressing buttons. And that's a leftover from the old concept of, well, we've got to go to these underdeveloped countries. I think the phrase was to bring soap to the wogs. How pompous is that? As if any culture that you went to that didn't have the steam engine was, by definition, inferior to you. Inferior and worth less than your culture. And yet, that was the atmosphere in which Rudyard Kipling was putting out his work, the imperial British occupation of India. And it was looked upon as right and just, and a foregone conclusion that this was the correct thing to do. And if you include a work of literature like that in with the satirical works of Mark Twain and some of the modern works, even if aliens were actually able to interpret those things into the closest equivalent to their language, what kind of picture could they actually form of who we were other than a planet of absolute mad beings. I have to grin while I'm saying that, because that's precisely the impression that they should get. I mean, if you take a look at the Earth from the outside in, if you just observe, then that really actually is what we are. I don't know how sane even the average, I don't even know how you would come up with an average level of sanity for the human race. I don't even know how you could do that. So there we had that babble. That might be fun to try. I don't know. Try it yourself if you come up with anything interesting. Once again, please write in or send an audio. But there's plenty of sites out there. I did a Google search for bad interpretation or misinterpretation, and of course there are plenty of humorous sites that'll come up with examples, particularly in the advertising and business world. Let me just pick out three of them because I've got long lists here, and I'll put a link in the show notes to at least one of these sites. Here we go. A sign in a Bucharest hotel lobby: the lift is being fixed. During that time, we regret that you will be unbearable. The Ford Pinto, when it was being marketed, they discovered that Pinto was Brazilian slang for tiny male genitals. What's another good one here? Here's one from a car rental brochure in Tokyo. An English translation from a car rental brochure in Tokyo. When passenger of foot heave in sight, tootle the horn. Trumpet him melodiously at first, but if he still obstacles your passage, then tootle him with vigor. So who knows what Babel software is going to come up with, depending on what you put into it. And of course, Babel Fish software takes its name from the Douglas Adams Babel Fish, which was his plot literary device for translating foreign speech into something you could understand. It took its name from the parable of the Tower of Babel. And I always had a problem with the Tower of Babel story, brief as it is. And I went looking for it. I looked it up. I don't have anything like this memorized, but I looked it up. Please don't be frightened. I'm about to read two sentences from the Bible. This is Genesis 11, 6 and 7. And the Lord said, "Look, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there, so that they will not understand one another's speech." Now, assuming that that is actually a correct interpretation of the original language from the original story of the original parable of the Tower of Babel, being charitable and recognizing it for what I believe it actually is, and that is a story to explain to people, a kind of a myth to explain to people why people all over the world have different languages. And the same reason that you assign animals and symbols to the zodiac sign is the signs of the zodiac for star formations, something to explain a portion of the world or an aspect of the world. This is why people speak different languages in different places. But if you were to take this as actual behavior of a divine being, then it just strikes, I don't know, it strikes me as kind of a dirty trick, really. It just doesn't seem like a very nice thing to do. And I have to kind of, I can't actually look at this as something that's telling me a universal or divine truth about the creator of the universe, that the creator of the universe would see one people and decide that, well, we can't have them understanding each other and proposing to do things that they can achieve. We'd better just go down and make sure that they can't understand each other. In other words, if you're going to credit the creator of the universe with that, then you're just going to have to lay a couple of other things at that doorstep too. In particular, the violent history that continues up to this hour. And I don't do that, actually. I can't. But there we have it. The ultimate miscommunication, or at least a popular printed version of the start of it all. What other aspect of this did I find interesting? Oh,
One of the most fascinating recent treatments of this subject you are probably familiar with if you have watched Star Trek The Next Generation. And this has probably already entered your head as you've been listening to this thus far. It was the episode called The Darmok, or was it Darmok without the? See, I can't even remember that. Yeah, I think it was Darmok, in which the Enterprise encountered a race that had been contacted marginally, briefly, whatever, by the Federation called the Temarians, or the Children of Temara. And while the universal translator seemed to work perfectly well with most other intelligent entities that they had encountered, it seemed to be working well enough with this particular interstellar spacefaring race, enough to get the words out that they were saying, but not enough to translate what it was they actually meant. In other words, they spoke and communicated with each other entirely in metaphor, entirely in concepts that were unique to them. And my wife and I found that we were doing the same thing as the Temarians, in a sense. And I don't know how to explain this. If you haven't seen the episode, it's kind of difficult to explain. But an example would be the captain of the alien ship had made a decision as to how to solve the problem. And essentially, in order to bridge the gap, in order to create some form, some bond, some method of communication, was to put both himself and Picard, the captain of the Enterprise, in a dangerous situation that they would have to fight their way out of together, essentially forcing the issue and learning through cooperation to communicate on some level at least. It ended up costing him his life, and of course it was one of the most memorable episodes because of that, and it was very well done. But he had made this decision to do this. His second in command was giving him a hard time and arguing with him, and rather than saying that was an order or shut up, remember who you are, I'm in command, he said, in winter. That was all he needed to say, was in winter. So the universal translator was giving you the words, but not his actual meaning. And yet you could interpolate, or you could extrapolate from that, be still, be silent, be frozen, whatever. But my wife and I were doing something of the same thing, making use of moments from the movies. What's an example of that? Now, this is that in order to explain this example, unfortunately, and it really kind of brings the point home, actually, in order to explain it, you would have to have seen the film My Cousin Vinny, and you would have to have seen the film The Money Pit with Tom Hanks, and I don't remember the name of the actress. I'm sorry to say, I should, but I don't. In The Money Pit, I don't know if you don't recall this, I'm sorry, I'm going to try and get through, let me try and get this through this as quickly as possible. In The Money Pit, a young couple buy a very large mansion at a bargain price, and they discover why they got it at a bargain price. It's because the whole place is falling apart. Literally falling apart is just an awful, awful wreck. And the whole movie is the amount of time, energy, and hell they have to go through, both financially and through their relationship, to get the place rebuilt, essentially, almost from the ground up. But in one of the earlier scenes, since they don't have working running water, Tom Hanks has to carry, by the bucketful, water up the stairs to the bathtub to dump it in, and then go back down and get more in order to take a bath. He gets the last bucketful into the tub, and fills it enough so that, you know, he can get in and take a bath. And the camera angle is to the floor below the bathroom, and the bathtub itself falls through the floor, down past the camera, and all we see is the hole that Tom Hanks and his young wife, is looking through. His young wife is just looking through the hole, slack-jawed in amazement and terror. Tom Hanks is laughing, is in a laughing, hysterical fit
to the extent that he cannot stop and the veins are popping out on his neck as he looks through the hole down at the bathtub that just collapsed through the floor. He could have gotten into it before it happened and would be dead, but just the fact that he had spent the past probably hour filling up this bathtub and escaped by moments losing his life in this wreck of a house that he had spent millions of $1 million on or whatever, laughing hysterically. Now, the way Mrs. Annam 5 and myself have made use of this as a Temarian, and we don't do this thinking, oh, let's be like Star Trek. We just do it, and it happens to be along the same lines as speaking in metaphor, like that Star Trek episode. If one or the other is having probably the most awful, awful day you can imagine at work and wanted to get that idea across to the other, all we'd have to do is get on the phone and say to the other, Tom Hanks, when the bathtub fell. The Temarians would say, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. We'd say, Tom Hanks, when the bathtub fell. Or if just a series, one after another, of lousy timing, rotten coincidence, and almost comic irritations like dominoes happen throughout the day or within the course of an hour, from a traffic light to a bridge that goes up to some broken item, a lamp bulb that goes out, tripping over the cat, breaking something expensive, whatever, all within a very short amount of time, and then having a phone call from somebody you don't want to talk to or somebody that's got bad news, whatever, one will turn to the other and simply say, Joe Pesci on the porch. That, of course, would be the scene where he's trying to study Alabama court procedures to save his nephew from being electrocuted and his girlfriend pressuring him about marriage and her biological clock as he's doing so. If you're unfamiliar with the scenes, all I can recommend is do yourself a favor and either rent or buy My Cousin Vinny. And I'd say rent The Money Pit. I don't know that it's really worth owning. There's certainly some fun moments in it, but I wouldn't go out and spend money on actually purchasing the movie unless you could find it at a real discount. But it's worth the time, if only for the one scene where the bathtub goes through the floor and he just laughs hysterically nonstop, probably for about a minute, a full minute. Well, you know what? I think that's going to do it for episode 18. I will put out an appeal here for anyone to write in the most humorous translation they can think of, the most humorous metaphor from a film, in order to get an idea across using English words that don't specifically say what the actual meaning is. Like Vetinare in any of the Pratchett novels, he'd say something on the order of, amazing. I understood every word in that sentence, but not the sentence itself. Send an audio right in. I'll read those on the next episode. If I get any of them, it might be fun. You may like it. I know I would. And what your thoughts are on the possibilities of communication. And I'll add this question to it, because there really isn't time to fully explore them in this particular episode, but if I get enough emails and responses to this question, then it might deserve its own, well, it certainly deserves its own, but it might be treated as an episode on its own. Are there forms of communication that transcend language? The examples that I can think of on a very broad sense would be mathematics. I mean, math is not something that's open for interpretation. It means the same thing no matter where you are on Earth or in the universe. The other would be science. Scientific study crossed borders and was quite successful no matter what country it was being done in, because it was the recording of facts and because it was developing a common language over time through history. So that cuts across the language barrier, and music also cuts across the language barrier. Maybe not over time, but certainly from one country to the next, Mozart is going to sound like Mozart, no matter what your native language is when you're playing it. You could also probably argue that the visual arts like paintings, cartoons, comic strips, anything that doesn't actually require a written interpretation or a written explanation to it, that would transcend language. And how much of that would actually get across who we were if we were to put examples of that out into space so that they didn't have to interpret the written word but could simply learn through mathematics, art, and music who it is we thought we were. Just throwing those out for anybody to respond to. Now a short piece of music, and beyond that, I'll be saying my goodbyes, and please enjoy this. And I played that piece of music because it was 103 degrees today, with humidity that made it feel like 206 degrees. Just an awful, awful heat wave. I really hope not too many people got seriously sick or dead from this thing that passed by. They seem to be getting worse and worse. But I've never been able to take the heat anyway. It alters my brain chemistry. Turns me to Mr. Hyde. I do a Jekyll and Hyde thing when the weather turns this hot. Can't handle it. Never could. But thank you very much for listening to episode 18 of International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. I don't know what the subject of episode 19 is going to be yet, but it certainly will be the episode, of course, in which I explain why the podcast is called International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. But until then, I hope everything goes well with you, and best of days.